From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1895 in Hartford, Connecticut. That's when the Hooker family decided that they couldn't afford the size and elegance of their historic Beecher Hooker house anymore. So they sold it to the Merrow family. But the Hookers left some things in the attic, a crate filled with papers. That crate survived two moves over the course of 70 years, eventually ending up in a barn in Mansfield, Connecticut. Now fast forward to 2010. George and Libby Merrow sold that barn, and they had about 5 years to clean it out. Eventually, while helping out, their son climbed through a broken window into a small side room in order to open a door that was stuck shut. And that's where they found the crate. Now, at first, they didn't think much of it. It was covered in mouse droppings. It had wedding invitations, things like that, that they could see. George and Libby took the crate with them back to their home in Bloomfield, Connecticut. And it sat on their porch for a year, covered in a tarp. So last year, while preparing to sell their home, they finally opened that crate and sorted through the contents. And what they found earned headlines in the New York Times, with some historians calling it the most significant find of its kind in decades. In that crate were letters from Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. They were sent to the suffragist Isabella Beecher Hooker. There were speeches, petitions, photographs, pamphlets, and newspaper clippings. The letters were written between 1869 and 1880. Just amazing. And we have so many questions. The University of Rochester has acquired the letters. And what can we learn about Anthony and Stanton that perhaps we didn't know before? When did Libby and George realize exactly what they were holding? What condition are the letters in? When will the public have a chance to see them? We have a lot to talk about this hour. First, I will welcome our guests in studio. Deborah Hughes is the executive director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Deborah, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be here.
Lori Burrell is the Special Collections Librarian for Historical Manuscripts at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. Hello, Lori.
Hello.
I've had to drink a lot of water. I'm already drying up. This is going to be a disaster this hour. Jessica Locker-Feldman. Thankfully, we've got great guests. Jessica Locker-Feldman is Assistant Dean for Special Collections and Preservation and Director of Rare Books, Special Collections, and Preservation at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And we are very excited to welcome on the phone Libby and George Merrow, who are joining us from Connecticut. They're the ones who discovered the letters in their barn. I understand they're both on the line. Libby and George, hello. How are you?
Hello.
We're very good, thank you. How are you, Evan?
I'm doing great. I was telling some of your story, but why don't we just kind of back it up here, if we could, George and Libby, because, you know, you're the stars of the hour here. You guys are the ones who discovered these old letters and, you know, this amazing find. And I tried to tell a little bit of the story, but really take me through the story of when you kind of discovered this and understood what you had there. Can you do that?
Well, well, we knew that the Hookers had owned the house before, and actually we had found a few other letters before and given them to the Stowe Day Foundation. And so when we found these letters, we figured they would like to go to some institution too. And we were very glad that our rare book person that we brought in had was able to get them to the University of Rochester where they could really be appreciated.
Okay, and so, but hold on, let me back up here and make sure I understand exactly the context of the house itself, because, you know, this is the Hooker family. You go back to 1895 when they sold that house. What do you know about the history of that house?
Well, they had the house built originally. It's in on the same street and in this Nook Farm colony that Mark Twain and his family were part of. The other end of the street, and they lived there for what, probably 25 years or so, maybe a little more, and apparently fell into harder times.
Okay, and so, and then we've got a situation where the Merrow family comes in, and since 1895 has been, you know, not only owned that house, but again, owned, I guess, the crate that kind of moved around. So the crate with the actual documents, the papers, can you describe, how big was this crate here? What did it look like? George, Libby? Oh, we lost? Oh, we've lost their connection. Let's do this here. So I know I worried about that connection. So let's go ahead. We'll pull back here while we establish with George and Libby. And let me just turn first to Lori Burrell, who's a special collections librarian for historical manuscripts at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. When did you guys know that this existed?
So the dealer reached out to us a little bit before Thanksgiving, and she was very kind to drive the material up to us right before Christmas, actually. And we worked very quickly in the library to be sure that we could secure the acquisition.
Oh, hold on. So when they call you, though, what are they telling you they have?
Well, it was an email, actually. Okay. So once I picked myself up off the floor, because it's not the kind of email you get every day, it was almost in disbelief.
They knew that this dealer emailed you understanding what they had. They didn't say, we're not exactly sure, you know, we think you guys can help with this. They kind of knew.
So she had been, it's pretty common that a dealer will put together a catalog describing the collection. So she had been working on that for about a year. And so she was very well aware of what was in the collection and its historical significance. And so she emailed us that catalog and we were able to look through it. And then as she brought the collection to us, it was just remarkable to be some of the first people to open those boxes, open the tissue paper and see that incredible signature that we all know here in Rochester. That signature of Susan B. Anthony was just very special.
Okay. What was that like for you, Jessica? And I know you said you're new at the University of Rochester. How new?
I came in July 1st.
Okay. So what were you thinking when these conversations were happening?
Well, as soon as I saw the email and Lori and I started to talk, we realized that this was something that we had to do. We already have such an incredible collection that documents women's suffrage that this seemed an absolute necessity for us to do whatever we could to make sure that this happened. So to me, it was very exciting. I've been in this field for a long time, but this area of collecting is relatively new to me. So seeing the significance and feeling the excitement from my colleagues really got me going. You know?
Sure. Absolutely. And by the way,
it's very exciting.
And Lori mentioned seeing the signature. I mean, I don't suspect there's a big market for forging old letters from Susan B. Anthony, but at the very least, you knew right away you were looking at the real deal.
I did, and that's the wonderful thing about having colleagues who are experts the way we do in the library. So when the collection came to the department for us to look at, there were about five or six of us looking, and we've all become familiar with Anthony's handwriting, the handwriting of other people in the movement, and it was because we were able to draw on that expertise, we were able to be sure that this was the real deal.
Deborah, when did you and the House know that these were potentially coming to Rochester, that these were out there?
Well, the information was shared with us, and then we had an invitation when Ann Gordon came to be here for our big luncheon in February. They invited us to have a sneak peek, and so Ann and I got to go over and spend several hours.
It was 3 hours.
Yeah. And
without leaving the room, which was really glued.
We would have been tempted to skip the luncheon. this collection is so full of fascinating material. It's because, you get Susan B. Anthony's personality, and it shows more than some of the things, you know, her biography, she got to edit what was included. But here you get some of the uncensored words. There were some things particularly about the Susan B. Anthony house we didn't know and some of the story. And we only had 3 hours.
Wow. Okay. So
that time.
And so again, do I have it right that the letters were between 1869 and 1880? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And how many total letters are we talking about here?
So there are 20.
Well,
no, they're closer to 100 letters, actually, because then there's also another group of letters that the Hooker family members exchanged. And
okay. And
that group shouldn't be overlooked either, because, again, you know, just as Deborah is saying, you get this really intimate look into someone's life, this unedited look into the activities that are going on.
And we know, obviously, Susan B. Anthony, but we're getting to know her more, and we'll talk more this hour of what some of these letters tell us about her. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, for those who don't know the suffragist Isabella Beecher Hooker, what should we know about her?
Well, one of the things that's so fascinating is that she's from a family that is probably one of the best-known 19th-century families. Her father was Lyman Beecher. Her brother was Henry Ward Beecher. Her sister was Harriet Beecher Stowe, and there were nine siblings, and they were 19th century intellectual, cultural superstars, very connected and very well known. So she was an important person in a lot of different ways.
Okay. And I've got George and Libby back on the line. Before I go back through their story about how they discovered these letters, how would you describe, Lori, the condition, the actual condition of the letters themselves?
So by and large, I would say the condition is incredible. It's as if they mailed them yesterday.
Wow.
There are a few where you can see those effects of the mice and the weather over time, but it's we're really lucky that the condition is as good as it is.
Yeah, just really maybe in the exact right spot to be preserved pretty well. And Deborah Hughes, how often over the years do we see letters pop up like this?
We're seeing them pop up right now because a lot of family homes are beginning to transition out of baby boomers' hands into others' hands. And this is a story of exactly what should happen with these letters, which is to find an appropriate institution like the University of Rochester that has enough information to really put these in a context, has the resources to share them with scholars and with academia. There's a growing interest in Susan B. Anthony and suffrage materials, and so we'd rather they get into these kinds of collections and available to the public than into the private hands of someone who might think it's a thrill but wouldn't make it available to all of us.
Sure. And before we read, we've got some excerpts to share, and I know our guests are going to want to weigh in on what we're learning from the content of the letters. We've got George and Libby Merrow back on the line with us. They're the couple in Connecticut who discovered the letters in their barn. And George, I'll start with you on this. We were just talking about that crate of letters. You know, can you take me through what you were thinking when you started to go through it? You know, how quickly did you actually understand the historical content of what you were looking at?
Well, the first thing we saw were on the, just lying loose on the top of the box were a few copies of a wedding invitation to the wedding of the hooker's daughter. And that gave us the idea that they might have some significance, possibly. So we passed the box onto a book expert, bookseller, and he and his partner went through it and found all the letters, and immediately notified us about it, and we decided to proceed to catalog them and try to find a home for them.
Libby, go ahead, Libby. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
This just shows you the value of never throwing everything away.
Hooray.
See, Uncle Paul had moved these things from, you know, when he emptied the house, he emptied it out entirely, moved it over to his house in Mansfield, then moved it over to the barn. So these things had been around. And so we're awfully glad they're out in the public now.
I'll say, and boy, what a bait and switch that is, wedding invitations at the top of the box and, you know, and then some of the most remarkable letters and documents that you could find inside of it. Libby, can you characterize, I mean, were you excited to find this? Did you feel nervous that you were in possession of something that, you know, as you say, you wanted to make sure you found the right home for it, but what were you thinking?
I don't think we knew enough to be nervous, sorry to say. Can't imagine. This is just one box, and the Merrows have saved everything, and we've got so much old stuff, but none of it from anybody as important as other families that happen to live in the house. But we have a lot of old stuff, and so it's been really fun finding what we had.
We cut out again there, Libby. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So Libby, I have to ask you this question only because I think it was last week I was talking to a guest who was mentioning that, you know, they were on the West Coast and some people were saying it wasn't exactly Susan B. Anthony who, but it was, you know, in Rochester, everybody knows Susan B. Anthony. And hopefully in this country, we're well aware of the history. But Libby, for you, you know, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, were those names that were big in your mind in history?
Oh, sure. Also, Isabella Beecher Hooker. She was a pretty fascinating lady, and now she's finally getting her due, which is wonderful. She must have been something. She paid for a lot of the early conventions herself, which no wonder she didn't have enough money to keep the house. And a spiritualist and just an interesting person.
Very good. Well, And now, Libby, when you got a chance to see the actual content of the letters, I don't know if you've had a chance to read them all, and we're going to be talking to Lori Burrell about actually looking at the handwriting and making sure you can read them. Were you able to read them and understand what you were seeing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they were really fascinating.
Did you find yourself kind of poring over some of the content? Did you have the same sense that, as Deborah Hughes from the Susan B. Anthony House was saying earlier this hour, you know, there's this idea that this is not edited. This is not a book with an editor and careful thought about, you know, what are we going to leave out? This is raw, you know, sort of unedited thoughts in a letter. You know, did you find yourself kind of glued to it, wanting to read more of it? Or you know, what did you do when you were taking a look at the letters?
Well, actually, we found other letters I was more, the letters we found 30 years ago, I was more interested in. These, we didn't even take time to look at them very carefully, so we had no idea that they were so crucial and so interesting.
George, what did you think of them?
Well, I guess that sums up how we both felt.
George and Libby Merrow on the line with us, the Connecticut couple who discovered this trove of letters, 26 letters from Susan B. Anthony, 10 from Elizabeth Cady Stanton, dozens from other suffragists, letters between 1869 and 1880. Lori Burrell, pretty good handwriting, or, you know, you mean that's part of your job is making sure we can read them. How was it?
So I've been fortunate to become very familiar with Susan B. Anthony's handwriting because, as Jessica was saying earlier, we have a very strong collection. Elizabeth Cady Stanton I'm less familiar with, and so when Anne Gordon was here, it was a real treat to have her lend some much-needed assistance. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's handwriting is very slanted, and, I don't know, S's and L's look similar, and it's much harder. With Anthony, I've kind of gotten the code down at this point.
Yeah.
Someone like Isabella Beecher Hooker, her handwriting is beautiful, so that was a real treat for those letters that are in the collection. And something else we noticed was that Paulina Wright Davis used purple ink, and that actually is much harder to read. The paper ended up being very thin. She wrote on both sides, and that purple ink is just, it's a bit of a nightmare.
Oh, interesting. Well, before we let George and Libby go, I just want to thank them for being willing to share what they found. And all of our guests here have already said the same, George and Libby, how appreciative they are of the fact that you did reach out. Did you ever consider, you know, feeling like, you know, saying this is in our family, this belongs to us, that, you know, this is for us, we'll keep it in the family, we'll get these analyzed, but we'll keep it for us, you know, or was it clear to you that they needed to be kind of out there in the public?
Well, we moved on and moved into smaller quarters, and we recognized that we don't have the space to save all of the old stuff that our family had accumulated. So we found that this was a very satisfactory way to handle them. And I guess I like to give some credit to my uncle, that we referred to Uncle Paul G. Merrow, who collected an awful lot of stuff, and we were responsible in the end for disposing of all the items. And it's been interesting and somewhat educational in the process of doing that.
And we're really, really grateful to the University of Rochester for appreciating it and bringing it to light and illuminating it so well so other people can learn from them. Thank you very much, University.
Well, boy, oh boy. I mean, you guys are almost honorary university employees. They are so appreciative of the things that you've had to say. George and Libby Merrow, thank you so much for taking the time for our program and for sharing the story, and I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's George and Libby, and you know, you get a sense for the history that was at their fingertips, and they seem, you know, like, well, you know, we got to find somebody who's going to do something with this. Jessica, what does that mean to you to hear them? I mean, they're very appreciative to the university. I know you're appreciative to them.
Well, and I think Deborah also said this as well, that we rely on people like Libby and George to recognize the significance, even if they don't pore over the materials, to contact somebody within the community involved in cultural heritage preservation and ask about what they have, because if it goes into dumpster, it's gone forever. So we are so thankful that people like them exist and recognize that there are things out there that need to be preserved and made accessible.
Does it make you wonder what else is still out there?
Of course. And there are surprises all the time. This is an especially significant one, but we always are ready for what's coming next.
Deborah, do you think about that all the time? This idea that there's more of the unedited, the private letters that could be found?
Sure, because everyone who writes history, it's their interpretation. And then we get some new twists or new slants, and it's like, oh, we always thought this was true. And that's more fun. The period of these letters hits two really interesting stories related to the movement. The big Beecher divorce adultery case that Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton were all aware of. And the period of Susan B. Anthony's trial, 1872 and 1873. So to get these new perceptions on stories that we've told that we have had in books, they kind of turn a couple things upside down. That's pretty exciting.
Well, let's do this then. Let's get our only break of the hour, and let's pick that up when we come back here. What have we learned from these letters? We've got some experts that we can share. We'll tell you about when you can see them. The public will have a chance starting, I think, in June. Is that right, Lori?
Yep. So we'll be doing an exhibit that's a companion exhibit to the big 2017 exhibit going on at the Public Library in Rochester, and we'll be featuring the Isabella Beecher Hooker letters at the university.
Yeah, what timing. 100 years for New York State granting women the right to vote, and so just amazing timing here. So let's get that break. We'll have some of the letters, and I want our guests to walk us through what they find to be the most significant news or development or understanding we have from these letters. We're talking to Deborah Hughes, the executive director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, Lori Burrell, special collections librarian for historical manuscripts at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries, and Jessica Locker Feldman, who's assistant dean for special collections and preservation and the director of rare books, special collections, and preservation at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. More in just a moment. Coming up in our second hour, how much do you know about co-ops? Well, Abundance Food Co-op in Rochester is growing. There's a new store. They have a new ownership drive. We'll tell you about how you can become one of several thousand owners at Abundance and what that really means. We'll talk about their expanding mission, how they want to add classes and activities, and some events tied to Earth Day. It's all coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's talk about what was in these letters here. And our guests, Deborah Hughes started to hint at certain things kind of being turned on its head or learning new things about what maybe Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton were thinking on certain important events or historical developments here. Was there a bigger surprise than anything else in this collection of letters that you found, Deborah?
Well, I was really struck by some of the things about the house. We didn't know that Mary had moved in with her sister next door for a while, being a little overwhelmed, and that Guelma, who had been dying of tuberculosis, had been in Mary's study, and they actually moved Mary's mother, Susan and Mary's mother, Lucy, downstairs in the front parlor to take care of her in this period of time. And that's a whole new story. For us, and to think about, we have in our mind what was happening in the house in different time periods. This is a whole new concept for us.
Do you feel like when you get those details, the house itself has more real life and real lived history now?
The house people feel that anyway.
Yeah, sure.
When you go to the house, you have that sense of. But yeah, to think, we thought this room had this function, and now we've got different people in it, a different story to it. And it kind of brings a whole new set of questions and new set of ideas.
It's amazing letters. Lori Burrell was just saying they're going to tell us what they paid for it. What did the University of Rochester pay
nice
for?
Nice try.
No, nobody wants to tell us that. Okay, well, that's undisclosed still. Lori, for you, what stood out the most? If there was one thing that above others that you either learned or were surprised about or kind of took a little bit of pleasure in seeing in someone's own words them talking about a certain event, what was it?
So it's kind of a small thing now, we're in 2017, but there's a letter from Hannah Comstock, who was a key figure in the Connecticut movement, just like Isabella Beecher Hooker, and she talks about speaking for the first time in public at a suffrage meeting. And this is, I think, 1871. And just the idea that a woman would take the time to write to someone else to share this really momentous event in her life, I think we kind of take it for granted that we can go to Twitter, we can go to Facebook, we can communicate and express ourselves almost at the click of a button now. But for a woman to stand up and speak publicly in the 19th century was a big deal, and it was a life-changing moment. And so that reading that one line and that one letter was really special for me.
And I know you have observed, Lori, that it must have been exhausting for them to keep this movement going in the midst of so many setbacks. You get to the period, as you say, in the 1870s, and they feel like they have tried everything, state, national. Susan B. Anthony, as you said, arrested for voting. There's so much that had happened there. Were you struck at all by anything in the letters, on that note? Were they feeling the exhaustion? Were they expressing anything in the letters in that way?
There's a great letter that Elizabeth Cady Stanton writes to Paulina Wright Davis in August of 1869. And I'm assuming this is a little sort of tongue-in-cheek. She's being a little sarcastic, but she says, quote, "I dread conventions more than I can tell you. And if you are willing, I will show my face in one again." And this is at that kind of critical point in the movement where the 15th Amendment, the debates around that are happening. There's sort of that split in the suffrage movement where some are working for black male rights, others are focused solely on women's rights. And I sort of read that exhaustion in Stanton's words there.
Hmm. She said, "I dread conventions."
Yes.
Is that a surprise, given what we sort of the historical image we have?
It's, as someone who studied this as an undergraduate, high school student, graduate student, it's sort of, I read that with dismay. I think of her as one of these twin pillars of the movement. That's how we think of Stanton and Anthony. And I don't always think of them as having these sorts of emotions, that yes, it was exhausting, and she wanted a break, and she's sort of asking for one, and I'm not sure she got it, actually.
You want to reach through the years and tell them, just hold on.
Yes, exactly.
Keep going. You want to prop them up in some way. And about that split, by the way, Lori, I think that's an important point here, too. These letters between 1869 and 1880, as you say, the suffrage movement was, considering black men. It was considering women, how to approach that, what the most effective way, national rights, state rights, those kind of things. How fraught was that split? I mean, did it ever really threaten the movement, or do you think it sidetracked it anyway?
I can only sort of speak to what I've seen in the letters, not sort of a broader historical perspective, but it certainly caused a lot of tension between the personal relationships these women had with one another. They were friends for decades and decades, and this was a really contentious time. They were having to choose sides or being compelled to choose sides. There's wording in these letters and others in our collections where people flat out say, "I'm not taking sides in this. I'm supporting the state level and the national level, and I'm doing what I can." And so you really see that the impact of those decisions.
And I think, Deborah, we've talked recently about the importance of distinguishing that, yes, there was occasionally tension or questions on, what should be first? Should it be African-American voting rights? Should it be women? But that doesn't mean that, Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony are historically opposed figures, or that Susan B. Anthony opposed rights for African-Americans, that there were strategic ideas or occasional frustrations. But occasionally you'll see, especially on social media where historians kind of debate a little bit, questions about Susan B. Anthony, race, and those issues. But I think it's probably important to point out that these were parts of the conversations at the time, but that don't mean that somebody was opposed to rights for others.
Well, I think with Anthony and Frederick Douglass, they had very similar ideals. They really believed in a democracy that would include everyone. Some of the other people in the movement didn't hold that to be true. So with Anthony and Douglass, it was a question of strategy that was different. I think Isabella Hooker, in a lot of ways, lines herself up much more with Susan B. Anthony on a lot of the issues than some of the other women in the movement. She was very much for women's property rights, totally believed in the necessity of a federal amendment to make it all happen. And so I think that's, yes, I think there are people in the movement with whom Anthony would have disagreed on the ideological ideas of why were we giving women the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
But she really did believe in universal suffrage and rights for all.
Jessica, what stood out most to you in this collection of letters?
Well, I think what stands out, I'm not getting into nitty gritty, but the idea that there are things to be discovered, that this is all so new to us. And even with the careful processing that has taken place, there are going to be turns of phrase specific sentences, ideas that percolate to the surface when scholars start to use these letters that will change the way that we perceive very important and some less significant pieces of history. So I think what's there is largely yet to be discovered, and that's what's so exciting to me.
Okay. And, you know, I certainly don't know all of the details of what's in the UR collection about what Susan B. Anthony has written, though my understanding is a lot of what previously has been in possession are letters that are more personal in nature, whereas some of these letters are sort of political. They get into organizing, you know, how the movement was working at the time. Laurie, is that generally correct?
I would definitely say that's an accurate representation. So in Anthony's letters to Hooker, she's talking very specifically about who to invite to specific conventions. If so-and-so is invited, be sure that this other person is also invited to speak. There's a lot of information in the letters about just what it took to participate in the movement, the travel that was required, who to reach out to, the kind of strategy behind petitioning certain members of Congress as they were working for a 16th Amendment that was ultimately unsuccessful. And there's a little bit of the personal with what Deborah was saying earlier, information about the House and other things. But what we see here is a real group of political minds.
Before I get into reading a few excerpts, I also wanted to ask Deborah if you ever go into a moment like this, hearing that, wow, we've got this trove of letters, 100 letters from suffragists, 26 from Susan B. Anthony, 1869 to 1880, this pivotal, I mean, every decade that Susan B. Anthony was alive was pivotal, but this pivotal time, and are you hoping to see, are you saying, boy, I hope that we get something about this, right? I really wonder what she was thinking or about this person or this moment, and we've never really seen expressed privately. Is there anything that you actually hope for when you look at those kind of letters?
I hadn't thought about it that way. I think one of the things that I love about this is that this takes a period of real intrigue. So what I hope is that we get new ways to draw people into the history. I mean, there's incredible drama when you get into the Beecher-Tilton scandal. Oh, people didn't know there was sex in the 19th century, or that there was a whole movement.
There was what?
Sex in the 19th century. There's a lot of evidence toward that. And
just the population of the species has me thinking probably.
Right. But. Who knew the suffrage movement had to decide how it stood on the free love movement of the 19th century and how Woodhull pictured into all of that. There's so many ways that when we look at the 19th century, we actually discover it's a lot more like today's moment in history than we thought and can speak to that. So what I love when we have a new discovery like this is that people get to plunge into the history and say, really, who knew that?
And not just because it's salacious. It's interesting. I'm thinking about what Deborah Hughes is saying here, and I'm actually thinking about one of my favorite historians, a musical historian named Robert Greenberg, who writes great biographies of long-dead composers. And he writes them in ways and delivers them in autobiography in ways that just, I mean, they are historical drama. And he says the same kind of things. Oh, yes, there was scandal, there was murder, there was sex. And sometimes, not just to be salacious, but to remind people that what's old is new again. And that you can be drawn in this way. And if it takes that to draw somebody in, Greenberg says to classical music, fine. You seem to be saying if this brings more people in to want to read this history, all the better because it's accurate, yes?
Yeah, well, and people sometimes assume that I don't want to have Susan B. Anthony critiqued. And the opposite's true for me. I respect Susan B. Anthony because she was a human being, because of some of the mistakes that she made, because of some of the ways she had to wrestle through some really challenging times, personal and political. And I actually like seeing the imperfections. And to me, that's much more engaging. And it also helps us more think about how are we going to be in this world today when we see how people were faced with significant challenges.
Jessica, is an interesting reading letters from this time because we know how this, again, the story is still unfolding, of course, but we know how the story ends, not only in Susan B. Anthony's life, but, you know, when suffrage would be achieved at certain points. She, of course, in this period of time, at all points in her life, was not going to be certain of that. Is there a poignance to reading those letters, knowing the achievements that she would end up with in her life, and seeing the struggle, as Laurie talks about the exhaustion, this feeling like, I don't want to do another convention that some of the suffragists have, or I don't want, you know, struggling to speak in public as some of them had. Is there a poignance knowing what they were on the brink of achieving?
I think so. I think a lot of the poignance has to do with that actual boots-on-the-ground work, that there is so much thinking and strategizing that takes place. So poignance is maybe not how I would say it, but it is poignant in the sense that the drive is so evident in what you read, that it really touches on really getting things done and solving problems.
I think that's such a good point. Yeah, especially when you think about what our kids are going to be learning in history books, that you know, if a section is rather short, it may seem a little romantic that women didn't have the right to vote, and then a group of women pushed for it, and yay, we got it. As opposed to look at the decades of struggle, look at the infighting, look at the questions on strategy and the way they felt rejected or ready to give up at times. I think that's the boots on the ground stuff, that maybe poignance is not the right word. Maybe it's appreciation for the hard work.
Absolutely, and it was incredible hard work.
Well, let me just let's read some excerpts if we can, and I'm just going to start with you guys because I've got some, but you know, I kind of want to defer to you. I know you've brought some, and Jessica, you have an entire letter.
I have an entire letter. This is the letter that we actually transcribed for Time Magazine online, and I loved it for a lot of reasons because it touches on so many things, but also for the fact that it's written both by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. They were obviously in a hurry, and they wrote this letter to Isabella Beecher Hooker on October 11th, 1869. It has so much, but the fact that it's Susan B., and then Elizabeth right after.
And again, the date of the letter is?
It's Monday evening, October 11th, 1869.
Okay.
Dear Mrs. Hooker, just in from the St. Louis Convention. This is Susan B. Anthony speaking. A splendid success. Mrs. Stanton in too. We read your note just here. Both say yes to Mrs. Wilbur, president of the Brooklyn, Connecticut Women's Suffrage Association. She is a beautiful writer and a good reader, and her presence is very, very good. Superior. Mrs. Livermore will probably say yes to you. She is coming to Boston soon. Told me the Boston people, had organized a stock company for a newspaper of $10,000 and were going to buy her agitator. She is coming on to make bargain. May come east to live, lecture, and edit the paper. Mrs. L. has evidently given her the fullest allegiance to the Boston movement for a new association. Mrs. Stanton says to be sure and invite Mr. Tilton and his precious little wife. Would not be only ornamental, but very useful. And this is on the eve of the scandal. So 1869, the scandal breaks in 1870. So that's Susan B. Anthony. And then right from there, Elizabeth Cady Stanton grabs the pencil. I would rather leave all resolutions and arrangements to you and only take on myself the responsibility of a speech. It is so pleasant to think that younger heads will do all that is necessary. So that kind of speaks to, oh, you do it. Can you possibly put your convention one day later, as my niece is to be married and she will put the wedding one day earlier so that I can reach Hartford in haste, ESC. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And then this wonderful PS, which I think is so beautiful. P.S. Whoever you invite will be agreeable to me. I can speak and work with all the children of men. So she's getting it done and doing whatever it takes.
Deborah, what do you think hearing those words?
Well, I love hearing that. I think that I'd love to know more about the exchanges about getting it organized and who gets to be at the table and who's doing what. And I think I love Stanton. It seems characteristic of her often to say, can I just write the speech? You go do the work.
Or looking for, as you say, the younger people who. Okay, so I've got, anything else you want to read, Lori, Jessica?
Well, I have one from August 1869 that Hooker wrote to Mrs. Severance. And this is a special letter to me because we talked a little bit about the handwriting earlier. And in this letter, we see some of the underlining that actually Stanton and Anthony are very well known for. And so Hooker writes, whether I can go as far as she in their support will depend on Miss Stanton's position in the matter of dress and divorce. I care nothing for the 15th Amendment anyways. That whole discussion will either be set aside by its passage or become the order of the day by its failure. And then we shall all have to take up in earnest a possible political issue. And then I think it will never pass without the 16th. And so she's in some ways making an argument that without a 16th Amendment on the table, the 15th Amendment won't pass. And of course, we know that that's not what happened. But reading how Hooker felt about the 15th Amendment and just what she thought strategically was going to work is very, very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so anything else you want to read, Jessica?
I've one good letter. I think that's plenty for me.
So I've got a few other excerpts, and I'd love to get our panelists' reaction to that. Before I do that, though, let me make sure you understand exactly how you can experience more of this coming up here. So, Lori Burrell, I'll start with you, and then we'll kind of just go around the table. What do you want our listeners to know about not only when they can kind of get a chance to see more of this, but anything else you want them to know? Here we are, 2017. It's a very significant year. So what's coming up here?
Absolutely. So the collection is processed. The description is available online. And so anyone is welcome to come in and use the collection. We've begun to digitize the letters, and we'll be putting those up in the coming months as well. And as we talked about earlier, starting in June, there will be an exhibit in the library in the Department of Rare Books and Special Collections that highlights items from this new acquisition.
Okay. Anything you want people to know, Jessica?
Well, that the exhibit in Special Collections is part of a larger exhibit that will take place at the big public library, and we're working with the house and with the public library, RIT, several other people, RMSC, to put that together. So that will open on June 2nd, and we're looking forward to a lot of other activities, the Votilla, which you should say something about, that's coming up in the summer. And then we're also looking to 2020, which is a very exciting time for the passage of the 19th Amendment nationally.
Okay. Deborah?
Yeah, Votilla.
We heard Barbara Blaisdell tell us about the Votilla last week. Tell us more about that if our listeners missed it.
July 17th to 22nd. We're going to be leaving from Seneca Falls the Monday morning, the 17th, with three packet boats, actually five boats altogether, with 30 reenactors telling some of the suffrage story and the related movements. We land at Cornhill on Friday afternoon, and on Saturday we're going to have the Suffragist City Parade. And groups or organizations that want to celebrate with us the theme of Because of Women Like Her are invited to march and be a part of that, going from Cornhill to the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood. It's going to be an amazing time to connect with the collections and draw people into the story about our history.
All right, so if you want to learn more about the Votilla, which is when?
July 17th to 22nd.
July 17th through the 22nd, you can contact the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House.
And you can go to votilla.org.
Votilla.
V-O-T-E-T-I-L-L-A.
Votilla.org. Not a flotilla, it's a Votilla.
It's a Votilla.
July 17th through the 22nd, so a lot happening there. Some more excerpts from some of these letters that were discovered. And here's a letter from Susan B. Anthony to Isabella Beecher Hooker, dated April 9th, 1874, after Anthony was convicted of illegally voting in Rochester. She concludes this letter by reflecting about the possible work women could do for the poor, the criminal, and the insane if they had power through the ballot. She writes, quote, "Now wouldn't it be splendid for us to be free and equal citizens, with the power of the ballot to back our hearts, heads, and hands, and we could just go into all the movements to better the conditions of the poor, the insane, the criminal. Wouldn't we be happy mortals thus to work with power, too? I can hardly wait. The good fates, though, are working together to bring us into this freedom, and that rapidly," end quote. All right, so that's more optimistic, Deborah, isn't it?
Yeah, and you also hear, sometimes you hear Anthony talking about just get the vote and then we'll sort it all out. But I think she and Hooker were more kindred spirits in terms of what they wanted to do in society. So you get her talking about what we could do if we got this far.
Okay. Jessica, what do you think when you hear that?
I get goosebumps. I do. It's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. And I love to hear the passion. The passion comes through.
Yeah. In some ways, I think, Lori Burrell, I think that is more of the better days, where the movement feels like we're going to get somewhere as opposed to exhaustion, infighting. That's a little different tone.
Absolutely. And when I was just hearing you read it again, the same thing happened to me from the first time I read it, which is I was tricked into thinking, oh, it must be the next year then that they're successful. And of course, I know that it's almost 50 years later before we get a national amendment. But she's so optimistic there. The good fates and rapidly. And it's just it almost breaks my heart that she never saw it. And just that it's felt so close to her, yet we know it took so much longer.
It's also striking to be sitting here in 2017, and again, this was 1874, that letter. Susan B. Anthony is talking about having not just determination, but actual power, a chance to do work for people who need it, to do good work for the poor. as she describes, the insane, the criminal. Are we not talking today about mental health, poverty, criminal justice reform? It's 2017. So in some ways, I wonder if she would feel disappointment. But those are ongoing issues today. So just really amazing. Here's a different letter. In a letter to Hooker dated March 19th, 1873, Anthony's impatience is palpable. So not talking about the good fates. She tells Hooker of her planning for the suffragists' regular May meeting in New York City. And she's kind of writing a stream of consciousness to her friend. She admonishes Hooker to show up. And she writes, quote, "But you must not fail to be there, for we must make the welkin ring anew with our war cry for freedom and our constitutional right to protect it by the ballot. I hear nothing from nobody. All I can do is run and jump to accomplish the half I see waiting before me," end quote. Deborah, what do you think?
Well, spring of 73, she's waiting for her trial that's coming up in Canandaigua. She's been on fire. I like Matilda Joslyn Gage's title for the speech, which is Susan B. Anthony isn't on trial, the United States is. And I think we're hearing that passion and frustration. You know, she's only in her early 50s at this stage of her life. And I think they saw a great triumph in the Civil War in terms of emancipation and moving ahead. And there's a lot of optimism. I think 20 years later, they've seen the emergence of the Jim Crow and feeling that the 15th Amendment became a barrier rather than a door opener. So we've got this moment right now where they're ready to run.
And it sounds, Jessica, that urgency of you better show up. You need to be there. You know, that boots on the ground. You know, because if any one of these incredible figures had just sort of given up at any point there, you wonder how history might have been different. That determination, for me, comes through in this letter.
Absolutely. Well, I think I hear nothing from nobody. It's, you know, where are you? You know, get going.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing it. You need to, too.
Well, and before we lose the hour, it's important to point out we've been focusing, of course, on Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in this trove of letters. But there's roughly 100 or so, I think, our guests were telling us. And there are more names and figures that, you know, certainly people like me, I don't necessarily do the movement justice by just focusing on Susan B. Anthony. And I think it would be helpful if all of our guests could tell us just a little bit about your sentiments about that, what we might learn from some of the other letters. Lori?
I think what we really learn is just more about the network of activists that we have here. And so you see in this collection, more than in any other that I've ever seen, how that network operated. And so you have Hooker in some cases serving as sort of a conduit where she's copying letters or passing letters on that she's received to other people. And you see just what that trail looked like. And so Anthony's words or her own words are being passed on to numerous people. And that's how people stayed informed. And that's, I think, what's really significant about this acquisition.
Okay. Jessica?
Well, one of the things that, in addition to letters, there are pamphlets and broadsides and things like that that Isabella Beecher Hooker collected and distributed. And it says, please, you know, a lot of them have pencil marks that say, please return to Isabella Hooker. So she was an information conduit that she really was not just spreading the word of her colleagues, but also sharing vital information about the movement and related things. So we really get a sense of her, the urgency of information sharing. So as information professionals, we love to see that as well.
Absolutely. Deborah?
When we think about the 1870s, we were still a tiny country. Half of our, what we now know as the United States, was territories. When we put that in the context of how much change was happening, there were so many people who were a part of the early movement, and yet it still really was a handful compared to what we see by the end of the century.
I think that's well said. Well, just amazing stuff, and you're going to have a chance to see even more of it. They're working on digitizing, but where would you send people, Lori, to learn more on these newly discovered Susan B. Anthony letters?
I would send them right to our website and to just reach out to Jessica or I or anyone in the library. We're happy to talk with people about it.
Okay, online where? Oh, boy, you have to Google University of Rochester.
Department of Rare Books Special Collections. We'll be right there.
There you go. It's newly discovered Susan B. Anthony letters and more, not just Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, so many of the other of the suffragists, the activists, the people involved in that movement that probably don't get nearly enough credit, but just really fascinating stuff. Our thanks to Lori Burrell, from the River Campus Library, Special Collections Librarian for Historical Manuscripts at the U of R. Thank you, Laurie. Great talking to you.
Great to be here.
Jessica Locker-Feldman, Assistant Dean for Special Collections and Preservation and Director of Rare Books, Special Collections and Preservation at the University of Rochester, River Campus Libraries. You haven't even been here a year.
I know.
We have a lot going on.
I know. It's wonderful. Well, so happy to be here.
Hope you're enjoying it. Thanks
I
for
sure
being here. We'll talk
Thank
to you,
you
again. And Deborah Hughes, we know we'll see you again soon, Executive Director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections next.